It's just, it's something in my innate personality. I want to do it. I want to do it right. This whole journey is to solve a terrible problem. We need to stop these preventable deaths, and we need to do it right.
Being really, really, really small is really, really, really hard. I think it sometimes seems romantic to be toiling away in a garage, but once you bring in help and you start to grow your company, things actually get easier.
Welcome to ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This show, like many, features entrepreneurs who could be successful anywhere. Unlike the others, though, all our guests, like you and I, choose Colorado. Success looks different here. Here, it's multidimensional, and that's why I say live, work, love Colorado. In this episode, as a way to kick off 2019, I'll be speaking with two Colorado entrepreneurs who are not yet on the cover of Colorado business publications, and I'm predicting that by year end, they may just be there. And these two entrepreneurs are at the opposite ends of the speed to market continuum, so I think you'll find this show to be interesting and entertaining. First, I'll be interviewing Dr. Arthur Kenowitz, co-founder, chairman, and chief medical officer of Securison Medical. His medical device company was founded several years ago when Dr. Kenowitz, an emergency physician, became frustrated with the frequency and extreme complications by something called unplanned extubation. That's when a patient's breathing tube comes out when it's not supposed to. He set out on a journey to fix that problem by inventing a solution, a product that has to get medical community and FDA approval. And he did this all as a one-man effort. That's a story you'll find really instructive and motivating. Second in this episode, I'll visit with Kyle Kosimba Benson, co-founder with his wife Rachel of Bivouac Coffee. It's a coincidence that Kyle, like Dr. Kenowitz, has a background in emergency medicine. Kyle is a mountain rescue EMT. He, with his wife Rachel, saw an opportunity to create a new kind of coffee company, one that uses unique production methods that produce a distinctive taste while addressing environmental sustainability in ways better than its competitors. Kyle's company won the 2018 Trout Tank competition and has recently been approached by some national retail brands to collaborate. I'll speak with both guests about their journey, what's led them to, I think, have them poised across the chasm from startup to what I'll call on their way, and their thoughts about key factors that will make that happen. I'm excited for these conversations, so stick around. Art, I'm glad you could be with me first. Thanks for sitting through the intro.
Dave, thanks so much. I appreciate being on your show.
I'm glad you're here, and thanks to my show sponsors, Community Banks of Colorado and MicroStar Keg Logistics. They support Colorado entrepreneurism, and they support this show. Thanks also to the Colorado Chamber of Commerce for its support for me and ProCo 360. Okay, on to the show, and let's start with Art again with Securison Medical. And Art, Securison Medical is right now focused on one product, the Solidarity medical device, and that prevents an airway tube from coming out accidentally. Take us back to that aha moment when you thought of the Solidarity and sort of how you got started.
Yeah, sure, Dave. Thanks so much. This started about 14 years ago. At the time, I was a medical director for one of the large ambulance companies here in Colorado. And although going back to my early days in medicine, I was a paramedic. I had experienced these unintentional removals of endotracheal tubes in patients that I was taking care of as a paramedic. But then as an ER doc, I didn't really see much of that. The aha moment really became apparent when, sitting there as a medical director, I started having these paramedics coming into my office almost daily saying, "Dr. K, the tube was in. It got pulled while we were moving the patient over to the ER bed, or it got pulled while we were putting the patient into the helicopter." I took that as very serious because when a breathing tube comes out, it's a life-sustaining breathing tube. Yeah. It has to stay in there. And when it comes out, that's a really bad thing. But I wasn't sure, was this just common in the field or was it common in the hospital as well? So I started doing some research. And I found that doing this research, that there was a ton of literature that said in the ICU, which is really one of the most stable places in the hospital, These patients, 7 out of 100 of these patients, wow, had their tube accidentally removed.
And that's, you know, it sounds like a small number, 7%, but the ramifications of that are really quite profound, right? So
they are. They're quite profound. It's 7 out of 100 just in the ICU. Mm-hmm. But there's 1.65 million patients in the ICU that are ventilated every year in just the United States.
So about a million, well, 100,000 incidents.
121,000 incidences a year. Mm. More importantly, it leads to 33,000 preventable deaths a year.
So this is the aha. You see this opportunity and you see that. But now a lot of people say, oh, there ought to be a better way. There ought to be a better way. So what went through your mind as you decided to try to make this?
Well, so initially my thought was we have to solve this problem. My thought was not to develop a device or to start a company, especially a medical device company. Yeah. But I thought we need to solve this problem. And I was sitting in my hot tub one morning thinking about this. I actually call my hot tub my think tank.
You know, I call the shower the think tank. I do. I tell my wife, we need to get a hot tub because I do my best thinking when I'm under hot water.
Yeah, I think it's because you get dilated vessels in your brain and it makes better blood flow. But anyway, I was in the hot tub and that was the aha moment. Ah, if we put something on the tube that causes a barrier to movement and it interlocks with the thing we put on the patient, then the tube's not going to move.
Got it. So you figured out in concept what you needed to do.
Yes.
So what did you go to your basement and start using a vacuum form or something? What did you do?
Well, yeah, it's funny because you hear a lot about Apple or, you know, Steve Jobs going into his garage and inventing, all of these things. Well, I went to my garage and I took a breathing tube and I actually went to Home Depot and found a bunch of O-rings that are used, you know, as washers, put the O-rings, a series of them, glued them to the tube, and I had an interface and it made it obvious that those O-rings caused an interface that would not allow that tube to move.
So you created a crude model, right? And then what went on in your mind then when you decided, okay, I'm actually going to make something that can get FDA approval? That's a big leap from creating a concept of, if only I had this, we could solve the problem, to I'm going to make this and make it an FDA-approved product.
Well, it's interesting because I went through a number of years even where I wasn't even thinking of starting a company. I was thinking of I had approached some of the big companies to see, would they be interested in the concept? And typically, big companies don't want to have anything to do with those until they've been cleared through the FDA. So they said, great idea, but no thanks.
Because a lot of inventors could and conceptually come up with a patentable concept, a basic design, and then sell it or license it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way in the medical device field. They want something that's made it through FDA before they mess around with it.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up because I had gone through the patent process. Oh, so we took the basic concept of this thing on a tube interacting with a thing on the patient that wouldn't allow the tube to move, and we went through the patent process. Wow. That was part of the time. But then it became time to, okay, I need to do something. I either need to sell the concept to a company, or I'm going to have to do it myself. And knowing that I'm a physician, I'm not a business person.
Yeah.
How am I going to do this?
Well, it's listeners, this is ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. And this is the show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm speaking with Dr. Arthur Kenowitz, co-founder, chairman, and chief medical officer of Securus and Medical. And we're really talking early on in this conversation about the idea of seeing a problem and then trying to solve it. Although in your world, trying to solve it means years of going through FDA testing and approval. It's not the same thing. In another podcast, you interviewed David Barnett, who created a little plastic device called Pop Sockets, and you stick it on their phone. And guess what? People don't care about who you are, what your background. You know, they just want to know if it'll solve your problem. Here, you've got a little piece of plastic, and people do care.
Yeah, they do care because medical devices have to be safe and effective. We can't cause more injury from the device than we're trying to prevent. And so the FDA has lots of regulations in place to make sure that before a device gets on the market, mm-hmm. that it's safe and that it's effective.
Well, and being an emergency physician, being a former ambulance
paramedic,
yeah. So having that kind of gravitas and expertise behind your name, I'm sure it's helping. And at the same time, you're one guy trying to come up with a product. So what's the balance of what they appreciate about you versus the fact that they know you don't know what you're talking about from a business perspective?
Yeah. So early on, I'm not sure that the gravitas, the reputation, any of that made any difference at all.
Really? I would think that would be the only reason they talked to you.
Well,
early on,
they really didn't spend a lot of time is the bottom line.
Yeah.
We really had to get much further along before mm-hmm. anyone was really talking to
me. I see. And speaking about getting much further along, I mean, you had a really interesting scenario develop because you created a patented, ready to market product that you then decided wasn't good enough. You were faced with a really key pivotal decision. We'll talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So we had our initial version of Solidarity, the Solidarity One. And as part of the FDA process, we had gone back and forth with them. They were concerned about, is this thing safe? And they decided that we needed to do a human clinical trial. During the human clinical trial, we had what's called a safety event. Now, the patient wasn't harmed whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It really was a user error. They didn't use the device properly. And so some things happened. They decided, okay, we don't know what's going on. We're going to just take this thing out of the patient and put another one in, which they did.
A standard one?
A standard tube rather than the clinical trial mm-hmm. device. And so whenever there's a quote safety event, this gets a lot of regulatory oversight. Mm-hmm. So we had a safety monitoring board look at it, and they essentially decided that this was a user error. Not a big deal. Go forward, redo your instructions for use, do some additional training. Not a problem. Move forward. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I said, that doesn't sound good to me, because if there's one person misusing it here, mm-hmm. there's probably a dozen more that are going to line up behind them and misuse it. And it's interesting because the FDA has more recently changed their terminology from a user error to a use error. Hmm. So we initially called it a stupid human error. Mm-hmm. It's now would be considered, it's a device error. And you know what? The FDA is right. It is a device error.
Because it's supposed to be designed in a way that there won't be user error.
Right, right.
Basically, right?
And we had spent lots and lots of time going through what we call human factors. So it's looking at different users. Can they use the device in their intended use environment and use it safely and effectively?
So you had to decide at that point, though. I mean, in this conversation, you're saying, yeah, you don't want to create that risk. And yet it's already been how many years?
It had already been probably 4 or 5 years at that point.
4 or 5 years into this thing. You had a product. The FDA said, yeah, it looks good. Let's test it and go. And you had to say no.
Yeah, I said, nope, we're not moving forward.
I mean,
forward.
Isn't that just spirit crushing at some level?
Yeah. At the point that we had the safety event, I thought the whole thing had gone down the drain, that we were done, that we weren't going forward with this. But, you know, we picked ourselves up, as we've had to do many, many times over this 14-year course. Mm. And we said, we are going to redesign this. We're going to take every single thing that we've learned from the FDA's comments, everything we've learned from human factors comments, everything we've learned from the clinical trial, and we're going to take care of and redesign every one of those issues. Mm. And you know what? We have redesigned it. We've gotten rid of every one of those problems, and we are several years later, but we're much better off because we haven't put a device on the market that wasn't as user-friendly as it is today.
Well, it's an interesting story, and I think a valuable one. It's also a story of patience in a world that's not very patient. What were you doing that related that you think to a work ethic and determination as you were growing up?
Well, I'm not sure so much as I was growing up that my work ethic developed, other than I think I kind of had an innate sense, an innate personality to work hard. Certainly my years going through the whole process of going through My medical training, medical school, internship, residency, that's a long, long process.
And yeah, but it's linear. But it's a linear process. Yes. It doesn't, you don't get to the last day of medical school and they say, hey, you need to take this class, you know, from undergrad over again, right?
Right.
So
right.
I'm interested in like what goes on in, to build the mind of a guy that's willing to say, I'm going to wait another 4 or 5 years.
I don't know what's behind it. It's just, it's something in my innate personality. I want to do it. I want to do it right. This whole journey is to solve a terrible problem. Mm. We need to stop these preventable deaths, and we need to do it right. We're not doing this just to get a business started. We're not doing it to make lots of money, although we are starting a business, and we need to get a good return for our investors, and I'm very aware of that. Mm-hmm. And that is – so I'm in charge of the mission. Mm-hmm. I have built a team.
Yeah.
Actually, my chief operating officer built a team around me, and that's why I brought her on and is my co-founder, because she knew what we needed to really make this happen.
Well, and I suppose that's it's a really thoughtful lesson in, you know, if you're really driven to solve a problem, then the idea of a user mistake is really getting in the way of solving this problem.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so creating a problem that's solvable no matter what, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's consistent. And that's a good lesson, I think, for tying a mission to a product success.
Yes.
And along the way, you've had to keep things afloat, and you've raised money into the seven figures. And I'm curious about two things. How did you approach raising that much money with really a fledgling nothing really of a business? And then as you start to try to raise money, I've experienced this myself, it's really tough to segment your time, your attention, your energy against product development, product approval, planning the business, all that.
Yes.
How'd you go through that?
Yeah, well, capital is king. You need, and especially for us at the beginning, because we essentially had an idea. We didn't at the time have any patents. We didn't have an office. We didn't have anything. We essentially had an idea. And so our initial capital raise, we went out to raise $2 million. And we were told, you won't be able to do it. It's impossible. In less than 6 months, we had raised the $2 million. And we went to friends, family, and colleagues. But we went to them with a concept of this is a mission. Mm-hmm. This is a problem that can affect you. It can affect your daughter. It can affect your husband. It can affect your grandmother. It can affect anybody. And we need to stop it. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like we were out there selling. Mm-hmm. We were out there telling a story. We were out there leading a mission. Mm-hmm. And people followed the mission very well.
Mm. And so over that period of time, for example, you raised the first round before you realized that your first product wasn't good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you had to go back to those investors and say, oh, what we made isn't going to work. We need to go back to the drawing board. And what was their take?
Yeah, well, we've actually had to go through three raises thus far. We've raised a total of $6 million, a little over $6 million to date. And we're actually in the process of another raise. We're hoping to raise another $4 million, $3.5 million here. Very soon.
For one product yet to be approved.
For one product yet to be approved.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah. And our investors have been very patient. You know, some have gotten to be not so patient, but the vast majority of them understand the mission. They understand the difficulty of going down this process, and they have continued to support us. Mm.
Well, that's a great story. Clearly, creating a medical device company is not for the faint of heart or for anyone in a hurry, for sure. So what would you say are some things a potential entrepreneur in this space ought to be thinking about?
Well, so let me give you an example of how I was able to get us to this point. And the point is that it wasn't me getting us to this point. I surrounded myself by the right people. The best decision that I made, and some people thought I was crazy at the time, but I approached my daughter to become the chief operating officer. I said to her, I have a mission, and I'm not capable on the business aspects of doing this. Now, she had never started a business before. She had never done a medical device product, brought it to market. But I knew she was resourceful. I knew she was intelligent. Probably very importantly, at the time, she was second in charge of the South Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce. Mm. So she had a network of business people, of financial people, legal people, business people, yeah. regulatory, the whole works. I knew that her network of special people here in Colorado would make the difference of us being able to make it or not.
Well, and we're talking today because based on what I know about Securus and the company seems poised, right, to have its product approved and available sometime in what we'll just say the foreseeable future. And what do you think has happened that you could point to as sort of a pivotal impact to get you to that place now?
Well, I'm not sure that there was any one particular pivotal impact other than, like I said, bringing on the team around me. So the first part was bringing on Elise, our chief operating
But they didn't really accelerate the process, did they, or have they?
Well, they have. And then we brought on our so I was the CEO.
Yep.
We brought on a new CEO. He helped build the team around us. And that clearly has – we have moved more in the last year and a half than we had in the previous
– By having a business-savvy leader.
By having a business-savvy leader.
Well, and Colorado's your home. It's your personal home. It's Securison's home.
Yes.
Has Colorado played a role, do you think, in Securison's development as a business?
I think so. Colorado has a fantastic medical community to start with. They've got a very progressive medical device community. Certainly, there's tons of support through the Colorado Bioscience Association. Mm-hmm. It's a place that encourages businesses to be successful, and they provide the help that you need to make sure that you're successful. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good to hear. I always like hearing that, and I'm one who believes Colorado has a collaborative community as well. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, very collaborative.
And as a physician turned entrepreneur, by the way, do you consider yourself an entrepreneur now, or have you offloaded that title to your hired hands?
I think I'm somewhat of an entrepreneur, but I think as a team we're entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So what have you done to learn things sort of differently that may be shaping your thinking or your approach to how you were 10 years ago? You know, what have you done to change that mindset?
Well, certainly, when I first started down this process, I was very naive and ignorant, to be honest. I knew nothing about business nor medical devices. And I have had to spend lots of time with lots of resources learning as I go. I run into a problem. How do you handle this? You go to the internet and you get information. You go to the library, you get information. So, you talk to people, you get information.
What do you think? This is a total guess off the cuff, but now it's been how many years since you first started?
14 years.
14. If you had the same idea today and you knew what you knew now, how long would it take you to get from start to now?
14 years.
Come on. No way. So you're saying you haven't learned anything repeatable?
I have, but the process is a very methodical process, and you have to go – maybe it would be 7 years instead of 14
But you'd
years.
Still, to be fair, as an inventor of a new product, the first round – has to go to be tested, and then you have to listen and watch for feedback, and you'd still have to refine it. You couldn't have invented it right the first time. That just doesn't happen.
No, you don't invent it. And that's the whole purpose of human factors. And you iterate and you reiterate and you reiterate until you get it right.
But you're close now.
I think to your earlier question, I think what would make my pathway not 14 years and make it 7 years is if I had surrounded myself with these people much earlier.
Yeah. Wow.
Because I was all by myself the first 5-6 years.
What's next in this journey?
Well, obviously our mission is to eliminate preventable harm and death from airway safety events. Unplanned extubation is one of the complications that occurs while you're having your airway managed in the hospital. There are lots of other complications.
Or in the field.
Whether it be in the field, in air medical, in urgent care center, well, not in urgent care centers, but in ambulatory care centers, surgical centers outside the hospital. So it doesn't happen just in the hospital.
So there could be ramifications, other kinds of things that you can explore as a company.
Yeah, we actually, over this period of time, while we've been going down this path, in a parallel path, we actually have developed a whole portfolio of intellectual property dealing with many of these
things you've learned along the way that or things that have become visible to you.
Yeah, as I've gone through the discovery process, it's like, oh, well, here's a way that we could take care of that problem. And, you know, unfortunately, I spend too much time in the thinking tank, and those things just come.
Well, and the thinking tank. Yeah, I need to get one of those hot tubs. So, hey, let's call this good for now. For part A of this podcast, and I've been speaking with Dr. Arthur Kanowitz, co-founder, chairman, and chief medical officer of Securus and Medical. Art, it's, I think, been really instructive from a standpoint of a mission-driven invention that the whole process to come along that way.
Dave, thanks so much. You know, hopefully this will get on the market because that's the only way we're going to start eliminating these 33,000 deaths a year. Let's get to zero preventable deaths.
Well, thank you for joining me. And let's hope that happens this year because I started the podcast. If for no other reason, I started the podcast saying, I think you're going to get there this year.
Yes.
So let's hope that
happens.
It gives
me a full year to do it.
Yeah, that's Listeners, please stand by for the next segment, part B of this podcast, where I'll be speaking with Kyle Kosimba Benson, co-founder of Bivouac Coffee. Welcome to part B of Pro Business Colorado, ProCo 360's podcast. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This is the show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. Part B of this podcast is my interview with Kyle Kosimba Benson, co-founder of Bivouac Coffee. Welcome, Kyle.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. And we should start by saying you're really co-founder with your wife, Rachel. She'd be here if she weren't days away from delivering your first son, right?
Yeah, we're talking about days and hours now at this point.
Well, I'm glad you could break away. I guess she gave you her blessing on this deal.
She sure did.
Oh, good. So now that you're here, tell us about Bivouac Coffee.
So Bivouac is a new coffee company, and we were founded in 2017. And we were founded to basically bring sun-dried, naturally processed coffee, which is popular in other parts of the world, and make it more prevalent in the United States, mostly for its environmental benefits.
We'll talk about the environmental benefits because that's really part of your mission, right?
Yes.
You spoke about, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but the idea that your mission is as important as your coffee.
It is. I would say that they're definitely hand in hand. But we're definitely a mission driven organization. I don't think that we would be here if it weren't for the mission.
And as you describe the mission, how do you explain it?
So coffee in general is a very, very environmentally degrading, industrial practice around the world. Hmm. It's very, very water intensive. It's very, very polluting, and we're out to basically create a hyper-sustainable, environmentally friendly coffee.
Because you said there's like, on your website, it says there's what, how many liters of water per cup of coffee? It's like, there's two numbers. One's like hundreds, but that includes rain and all that. But when you include the washing part, how many liters per cup of coffee?
So altogether, we're talking about around 396 liters of water. Get used to produce a standard American 12-ounce cup of coffee. About 2% of that is actually water. 1 to 2% of that is water that gets used to wash coffee, which sounds like a relatively small amount, but that actually equates to around 8 days of drinking water for somebody.
And that water, when they wash coffee with it, goes often as you is polluted. It goes right back into the streams or whatever.
Yeah. So unfortunately, a large portion of the world doesn't have adequate infrastructure to handle wastewater, and the wastewater that comes out of the backside of washing of coffee is around 30 to 40 times more environmentally toxic than human waste.
Wow. And that goes straight into the rivers, stream, whatever, right?
Right.
So this is the mission, right? Because on your website, you say you care as much equally about the mission of sustainability and environmental sustainability as you care about the taste of coffee, for example.
That's
but you care
correct.
About both.
Yeah, of course.
So thinking back now, this proof of concept, when you produced your sort of first batch, I mean, what went through? How did you decide to make your first batch? What was that all about?
So going back to, I guess, the origin story of the company, my wife and I are definitely adventure travelers, and we like to go down to Central America to surf. And we got introduced to this sun-dried coffee on a surf trip in Central America several times and came back to the United States and couldn't find it reliably. And then in the depths of trying to find it, I stumbled across a study that was done by the Water Footprint Network, which is a NGO that's based in Holland. And they were the ones who kind of opened my eyes to the environmental harms that wash processed coffee provides the environment or causes the environment.
Mm. So what then happened? Do you buy beans and go?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. We retrofitted a garage. We happen to live in a nice mountain community where we have some land, and we're able to retrofit a garage into being a roastery. It included basically building out this standalone building into a true coffee roastery with a warehouse side and a production side, and then started to work under what's called the cottage food law.
That requires less packaging, labeling, less restrictive kinds of stuff to develop new products, right?
Kind of. It actually allows you to produce a product out of your home as long as it's sold direct to consumer. So it basically allows a food entrepreneur to experiment and to grow a business to a place where it's viable from a home.
But you still have to have a license to do that?
There's a set of guidelines that you have to follow. There is no specific licensing in Colorado.
So did you decide to get this started with Rachel? Did you just buy a 25 pound bag of coffee or what?
Yeah.
Have it sent to you from Central America and it shows up at your house. You're like, okay, now let's make coffee.
Well, the first time I ever tried to roast coffee on my own was in a cast iron pan on a stove. I'm just kind of trying to learn about it.
Yeah,
I bought a little bit of coffee from a green coffee supplier for a home roaster. It's called Sweet Maria's. Mm. That's very, very popular in the home roasting space. Mm. And then realized really quickly that I really wanted to do it. And we started with 250 pounds of coffee that we had imported. And then we bought a roaster that was made in China, imported by a company that's in Minneapolis, that roasts right around 3 pounds at a time.
Oh my, that's like nothing.
No,
how long does it take to roast 3 pounds?
Anywhere between 12 to 15 minutes.
Oh, all right. So it's not that, but still it's an all day thing to get any kind of results. And is there a different, like when you try it, my son just gave me a beer making kit for the holidays and I'm waiting for the first batch. And I can only imagine that after I've done 10 or 20, it's going to be a lot better. Is that how coffee is?
Yeah, it's a continual improvement. And the thing that's interesting with coffee, a lot like beer, is that every coffee requires different inputs to get different flavors. And a lot of it is cupping, or we call cupping or analysis of coffee in the roasting profile to make sure that we're able to highlight the natural flavors that exist within that coffee without over roasting them and making them taste burnt.
So that means that every time you try a different coffee, you also have to learn how to roast it properly before you can sell it?
There's some pretty good basic guidelines that we work with in our approach to roasting, but every single coffee gets sample roasted, as we call it.
And then a profile
is built around it.
So you might have to test it, sample roast several times before you get to where you can create a batch that you think is deliverable.
Right. And the thing that's interesting about how that works now in modern coffee roasting is that everything is very computer data driven. So we have a bunch of different thermocouples that are attached to our roaster, and they measure all of the change of heat and the heat in different types of different times of the roast that allow us to create our repeatable profile for our coffee.
I wouldn't have known that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And tell me, there's an app on your phone that directs it? No.
Not yet. No. I think people have tried it. I don't know how successful it's been.
Hey, you're listening to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. I'm speaking with Kyle Kosimba Benson of Bivouac Coffee. Go to ProCo360.com to subscribe to the newsletter, read my blog, and catch the books I'm listening to on Audible. Also, please rate ProCo 360 in your app. And, you know, as you were getting this business going, Kyle, I was thinking back as I was preparing about an interview I did with Lee Mayer of Havenly. And she and I talked about this. Well, she really talked about this idea of really, really listening to feedback and not just from friends and family, because your friends and family always tell you how awesome you are. What things did you hear that made you make changes along the way to how you produce your coffee?
You know, from the very, very beginning, we obviously started as a direct-to-consumer company. And we're going out to try to activate our local community around the coffee and try to get feedback. So we got a 10 by 10 tent and a table, and we're going to partner with some local retailers up in the mountain town that we're based in called Evergreen. Got some feedback from our local coffee connoisseurs, and have kind of definitely shaped everything that we've done around those tastes and also, the service model that we provide.
Yeah. But you, I mean, the people you asked are people who are really discerning, right?
Yes. And you know, necessarily we also want to be approachable to everyone. So from the true coffee connoisseur all the way down to someone who really just enjoys their good cup of coffee in the morning.
Well, and I think this is a good point in our conversation to pivot a bit, because there must be 10,000 people like you, like Bivouac out there, and yet you're starting to get traction, which makes it really interesting to me now. And you won Trout Tank, for example, which is a competition hosted by the Metro Denver EDC. Let's talk about that. Why'd you even enter something like that?
So in general, we started as, like I said, a mission-driven company, and we were focused on a mission and a product. But a company requires a lot more than just a mission and a product and a drive and values. It requires things that I didn't understand and didn't know.
Like what?
Finance. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand how to make a proper business plan, how to create an operational plan. I really honestly didn't even know what a lot of that meant. I just know that I really liked this coffee and I wanted to bring it to the world.
And so in preparation for Trout Tank competition, are those some of the things you had to learn?
So along the way, the biggest benefits that came from Trout Tank are really learning how to interface with investors and also how to pitch, which is quite the skill in itself.
Yeah.
Creating, basically diluting this giant idea that you have in your head down to, you know, a 5 to 10 minute presentation that basically summarizes everything and of where you've been and where you're going. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find interesting about pitches, and I've heard pitches on whether it's Trout Tank or Shark Tank or whatever, I find that entrepreneurs feel like they know what they're talking about. They've got it all locked in their head, and they really don't until they actually do have to make a pitch. And it crystallizes a lot, even for them, where they're going and what they're doing. Is that part of what you experienced?
Very much. I think there's also a lot of like an easy way for us to think that we have all the answers to our product or our service locked away in our head. And then when you put it down on paper, you definitely see the gaps in your operating plan or plan that you have in your head. And that's a great thing that comes along with pitching or going through any kind of accelerator program.
Or getting ready for the questions people might ask you, or like, what if they ask me this? I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, most businesses fail in 1 to 2 years. You're only a year or two into yours.
Year and a half.
And they fail even after 5 years, right? So what do you think you've done right that's getting you to go from like 5 figures last year to 6 figures this year that you're projecting? A couple of any examples of things you feel like you've done right?
I think we've done really good in trying to find something unique. In general, we've also done a really good job of sticking to our mission and educating our mission about our mission. And having people really buy into what we're trying to do in a larger level than this is just something that tastes really good.
Yeah. And tasting really good is a good thing.
It is.
And differentiating yourself by mission, I think, right? That's the 1-2.
Yes.
Which do you think is more, if you had to decide, is one more important than the other?
I think the mission, like I said, we wouldn't exist without our mission. I think that if I had to choose, that would probably be it. But we also probably wouldn't exist if our coffee tastes pretty bad. So.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
And your business is still young, but still, I mean, at this point, what do you wish you had known when you started?
I think bringing in people who have other strengths than you from the very, very beginning would have been very helpful. And also, that being really, really, really small is really, really, really hard. I think it sometimes seems romantic to be toiling away in a garage, but once you bring in help and you start to grow your company, things actually get easier.
Well, when you say it sounds romantic being really, really small, I mean, what are you picturing in your mind when you're like, yeah, I thought this would be romantic?
I think a lot of people have this romanticized idea of entrepreneurship, of someone who quits their job and toils away in their garage and in order to try to make a change in the world. And the reality is that as one person, it's really difficult to make a really large impact, especially as a business. And nobody holds all the answers. When you put everyone's minds together, you can do really remarkable things.
Mm. So you can pursue the mission a lot faster, a lot more.
Yeah.
With people around you.
Yeah, the mission and quality. Mm.
And you recently went from your home-based, you described your garage-based roasting facility. You've recently expanded. Now you're in the process of moving to a production facility, right?
Yeah, so we've actually taken an intermediary step there where we used a commissary roastery. Mm-hmm. And now
basically a contractor.
A contractor, yep. Right, actually just to use their facility.
So you did it in their facility.
We did it in their facility. Mm-hmm. And then we now have our own production facility that's being built up in Evergreen.
That's exciting, isn't it? More challenges, more issues, more money.
It is. It's also really fun. You know, I definitely like the construction part. You know, I'm great. We're sitting here today, and earlier this morning I had, you know, my hard hat on putting up walls in the new roastery. So it's definitely a fun part of entrepreneurship.
That's cool. And Colorado is your home. You grew up here. What role does, I mean, you're talking about Bivouac brand coffee. Yes. What role does Colorado and Colorado branding play for Bivouac?
Well, we're definitely branded as an outdoor industry style coffee company. We're definitely a coffee company that exists within the outdoor industry. We also partner with a bunch of outdoor industry nonprofits that are based in Colorado. But in reality, when it came down to branding the company, it's what I knew. I had existed in the outdoor space for a long time.
I mean, you're an emergency rescue guy, right?
Yeah, I'm a mountain rescue paramedic, ski patrol paramedic. Been a firefighter for a long time in the mountains. And that's just the branding that I knew and felt comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And it also happens to be the right demographic for our brand.
That's cool. And you mentioned outdoor industry several times, and you've been doing some interesting guerrilla marketing too for your brand, right? You've got this crazy truck, and you're doing an arrangement with the Outdoor Retail Industry Trade Show. So talk about that.
So we're getting ready for the Outdoor Industry Retail Show at the end of this month, and where we're going to co-booth with one of our outdoor industry and nonprofit partners, the American Alpine Club, and hopefully be able to spread our brand that way. And we're also excited to actually activate with some of the brands there that we have kind of created small partnerships, growing partnerships, and see where they go. It's definitely been a unique path for our coffee company.
And it's kind of exciting. I know you can't name any names. You told me already ahead, but now you've got companies like bigger name retail kind of companies reaching out to you to see if you're interested in partnerships.
Very much.
So how's that? I mean, what did they just call you up and you answer the phone? They say, this is so-and-so from a company you recognize. And
kind
you're like,
of. There's also, there's
to your pants or what?
Yeah. There's definitely like some starstruck moments.
Yeah.
You know, I think every entrepreneur has that when they start to see traction and success. But definitely I think that we start to see that. And, you know, every day, you know, my business partner, Renee and I kind of look at each other and we say, man, we're getting somewhere. And that's a really cool place to be in life.
Oh yeah, for sure. And thinking back, because I know your family, you were raised by a mother who's a clinical social worker and a father who's a really dynamic pastor. Neither of them from the world of business, you know, neither of them preparing you at all for the world of business. So where does all this come from?
You know, I think when you go a little bit further back into my family history, there is some business in my blood on both of my grandparents' sides. Mm. And I think it's something I've always been interested in, and not necessarily that I knew that I was interested in business, but I knew I was interested in creating something that mattered. Mm. And the word there is creating.
Yeah.
I think I've always had that creative vibe.
So you think you were really drawn towards the mission that motivated you to create a business, or did you want to create something and the mission sort of works with it?
I wasn't going to create anything that didn't have a mission. Mm.
Got it. And before we talked about before Bivouac, you being a mountain rescue EMT, and this might be a stretch, but did you learn anything on that job that you're using and applying now?
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, through mountain rescue emergency services in general, a lot of it is extreme customer care, if we want to look at it that way. Mm. You know, as a firefighter, you are asleep in the middle of the night and a red light goes on above your bed and you have 90 seconds to be out the door to go help them. And a lot of those lessons transfer very well into business. As well as team management and leadership. Yeah, as a paramedic, usually in an urban or even in a mountain environment, in mountain rescue, you learn a lot of team management skills.
But, you know, as you were describing the red light going on off and on, thinking to myself, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs fail because they let everything be an emergency.
Yes.
So, right? I mean, you could go that way, too, and just sort of succumb to the notion that everything's an emergency. You'll handle it when it comes up.
You know, that's been an interesting growing point for myself, because I feel like that was my original nature. Mm. And the thing that's really actually caused some great growth with me and myself as an entrepreneur and with our company is that we ask ourselves, is someone dying right now? And I think that that actually allows us and gives us a lot of really good clarity in our business decisions.
Well, that's a really, you know, that's a pretty good mantra, I think, is because everything seems like an emergency if you let it, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. And we mentioned you're about to be a dad. And have you talked with Rachel about like how you're going to manage life after when you're a parent and you're still a scrappy entrepreneur who has to make money at some point, right?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I actually just finished reading the family business book that was written by Yvonne Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia's wife.
Wow.
And the plan right now is to fully integrate fatherhood into the business and actually part of it, make it part of our culture. Mm. We want to make sure that we have that for all of our future employees that we're bringing on and also for my family.
That's cool. Hey, for listeners who want to try your great coffee, how do they find you?
The best place right now to find us is online. It's www.bivouac.coffee.
Excellent. Well, Kyle, thanks for joining me today on ProCo 360. It's been fun talking.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and today on ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado, you've been listening to my conversations with Dr. Art Kanowitz of Securison Medical and with Kyle Kosimba-Benson of Bivouac Coffee, both high-energy entrepreneurs running Colorado companies that I'm predicting will cross the chasm from startup to traction in 2019. Thanks for joining me again on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you, I, and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast and by submitting a review. Thanks to show sponsors, MicroStar Keg Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, Jones & Keller, and the Colorado Chamber of Commerce. And thanks to my show engineer, Mike, here at 3rd & James Studios. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.
That's it.
Cool.
So what do you think?
That was fun.
Did you do okay?
I think I did okay.
Did you say what Rachel wanted you to say?
Huh? Well, one of the things I want to talk about was that how crucial an operating plan is. And we kind of got through that through a little bit.
We touched on that a little bit, but yeah.
I think it's interesting. I think a lot of people come with this idea of like, they have a great idea. They have a passion.
Yeah.
And I think that it's easy to start acting on that passion, which is really the true key, right? A lot of people just don't ever start.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And then, taking that next step is really, it's a big step.
Yeah, to actually turn it into something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to sustain it, because it's not always easy, right? I mean, you've had problems.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a learning experience and a growing experience, and it's definitely awesome.
But you seem committed. I mean, you seem in.
Yeah, I left my day job.
Yeah, cool.
Yep.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you had a good time.
Thanks.
I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I did.
Good.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.